The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Advice and expertise on the relief you need from hay fever at All Care Community Pharmacies across Ireland.
We're going to talk a bit now about Cladda Records. Cladda Records is kind of one of those mad chapters in Irish life where a member of the British Ascendancy, who kind of, I suppose, liked hanging around with musicians and creative people, squandered a good chunk of his fortune on setting up a record label that released all kinds of unlikely records. But I think in retrospect, it's left us with this very cool legacy. And I think a lot of people would say it did a lot to kind of save and preserve traditional music here. So James Morrissey, I'm going to talk to first. And James, you're the current chairman of Cladda Records. James, it's a kind of a wonderful, colourful, mad story. Will you give us a quick explainer first on who was Garrick Brown and how and why did he set up Cladda Records?
Garrick Brown grew up in Clamorris in County Mayo, and when his parents separated, they moved to Lugalaw, the magical place in the Wicklow Mountains, which was owned by his mother, Una Guinness.
And she was one of the Guinnesses.
She was one of the Guinness. She was known as one of the Guinness girls, three sisters. And Garrick grew up there with his brother Tara. And it was an idyllic existence. Garrick's mother told him that she wanted to teach him how best to handle money, because the rest was probably easy in life. Garrick, his schooling took place in lots of different institutions, and in one case he sent a letter in his mother's hand saying, "I want Garrick home immediately. I can't live without his presence anymore." And Garrick got out of that school. In his teen years, he listened to Kieran McMahona of this parish and took a great shine and grow to Irish music and listened to it non-stop. He actually mentioned in one of the tapes that I did with them that he recalls at 3 years of age hearing Irish music on the radio and dancing to it. And in his late teens, he started learning the pipes from Leo Rosen. And along with Ivor Kenny, they tried to get Leo Rosen recorded by one of the major record labels. And they said no, and people wouldn't be interested in piping music like that. And Garrick decided he's going to set up the company. And himself and Ivor set up Cladda Records in 1959 when Garrick was 19 years of age.
And then there's an archive, I know, which was left in a vault in the Bank of Ireland with everything to do with Cladda. And I think Garrick kept it with a view to doing something with it someday. And then how did you get mixed up in all of this?
Well, I knew Garrick from my student days in Dublin. When he was starting off with Cladda, I was working with the magazine to earn some part-time money, Spotlight magazine.
Oh, yeah.
And I met Garrick frequently at Cladda launches, and we always tried to make sure that there was coverage in the magazine, although this was at a time when people were more interested in pop and rock than they were traditional Irish music. But I always tried to fit in something in the magazine each week. And we got to know each other and had a long friendship over those years. And I would meet him intermittently. And then in recent years, I happened to meet him in town one day and he said, "Why don't you come out to the house?" So I went out to the house and he said, "Look, I want to revive Cladda. And I also would like the story of the history of Cladda written. Would you be interested?" And I said I would. And we started working on that and had about 10 or 15 tape sessions completed when he died in March 2018. And the trustees asked me then, would I be interested in getting involved in the revival of the record company? And as you say, 40 to 50 boxes in the vaults in the Bank of Ireland, all reel-to-reel recordings, original recordings, some recordings that we don't know anything about, but we hope we'll uncover. So it really is a treasure trove. And together with that, then, there are the letters, the contracts with Samuel Beckett, Patrick Kavanagh, the Chieftains. So it really is, it's a window into our past. And the one thing that I always felt with Garrick was that he felt towards the end of his life that he really hadn't made much of a contribution to anything.
Yeah.
But this is quite something. This is an incredible archive.
Yeah, and I see that Universal Music now have bought the archive. And I suppose I was thinking about why they would, but you know those Lomax recordings in America where they headed out with the van and recorded hillbillies up in the mountains playing their music and all that. In a sense, I suppose, Ciarán MacMahona, who you mentioned, and then these recordings, these are kind of our Lomax recordings, aren't they? And the roots of a lot of music is in there.
They are. In relation to Universal, what we've done is we've signed a licensing agreement with them that they can license our product and issue it, because Garrett wanted the Cladda repertoire archive to be made available to anyone that might be interested. And in relation to Alan Lomax, Bono has said that Garrett really was the Alan Lomax,
Lomax of
Irish music.
And what kind of stuff is in there? Give people a flavour.
Well, there's an awful lot of music. I mean, you have Liam O'Flynn, you have the Chieftains. The Chieftains recorded their first album on Cladda. The first six albums were on Cladda.
Did Garrett kind of put the Chieftains together in a way?
He did. The Chieftains themselves wanted to call their group the Queer Fellas, but Garrett said, no, I don't think that'll work. So I think you should call yourself the Chieftains. And then you had the spoken word, Patrick Kavanagh, Seamus Heaney, several Scottish poets, John Montague, Tom Kinsella. It's a vast repertoire, and Garrett drew an awful lot of people into the whole circle. I mean, I came across a letter when I was researching for this last night, a letter from Peter Sellers. One evening that'll always linger in my memory, me and my mate Spike Milligan. I'd been telling Milligan about my friend Paddy Maloney. Milligan was in one of his Irish moods with a tipple in his hand, like to steady himself. In comes Paddy, and within seconds they were in love, in the nicest possible way, of course. Out comes Paddy's flute, and he blew magic into the room, playing up a storm, and he plays an air that haunts you, and the tears begin. Oh God, it's beautiful.
And of course, a lot of this cross-fertilisation between people like that happened at these kind of legendary parties down in Loughlin, didn't it?
It touches the Hotel California. You can check out, but you can never leave. And Garrett was very polite with people. He would never ask anyone who was overstaying their welcome to leave. I mean, he was too polite. But one bad winter, about 10 years ago, when it looked as if Loughlin was going to be snowed in, a house guest who wasn't showing any sign of budging was beginning to get on Garrett's nerves. And Garrett said to one of the staff, I imagine being stuck down here with a cupboard full of baked beans, a leg of lamb, and your man. One of us has to go. And it looks like it's going to have to be me.
Okay, now, Mary Hayes is on the line. And Mary, you were Garrett Brown's librarian on and off for years. You answered an ad in the UCD library, I think, and you had no idea who he was or what you were letting yourself in for. So describe the scene you arrived down to in Loughlin then. I gather a huge collection of thousands of books, but complete chaos.
Total. Yes, I answered an ad and I didn't drive at the time, so I got collected by the estate manager, Shane Bisgood, at the time, and he collected me at the station and Ray brought me down, and I'll never forget the journey from the top gate right down to the house. I mean, it's incredible. Magical, and I was blown away by it, and also how steep it was, and thinking, my God, I'd never be able to drive this myself. Got down there, met Garrett, and I thought, oh, he's a strange little man, all beautifully dressed up, and I'd never really come across anybody like him, and I couldn't really quite understand what he was saying, because he had a way of speaking that your ear had to become accustomed, or certainly my ear had to become accustomed. But basically, he had a collection of books all over the house, different rooms, under beds, presses, everything, and so I was the only person, I think, that applied, and so I got the job. And I
gather you developed a kind of an odd friendship then, where you'd sit on the bed sometimes drinking champagne with him. On the bed, I stress.
On the bed, on the edge of the bed, and it was only on one occasion I was having a glass and asked me, would I like to join him? And of course, yes, beautiful champagne, 11:30 in the morning, half a glass of champagne, looking out, the deer were there, and wonderful. And then I got back and did whatever I had to do that day. We actually were discussing catalogues because girls always take the time, you know, whenever you would came into the room or whatever, to look at something.
Okay, and, listen, Mary, your line is getting very bad there. We'll ring you back, okay? And I'll come back to you in a minute because there's a few more things I want to ask you about. Musician and broadcaster Padder O'Riordan, good afternoon to you. You're down in Radio na Gaeltachta in Gaeltachta in Ballyvourney.
Well, good morning, Buck.
How are you, Padder?
Listen, Ali says hello if you remember him from Cork.
I do, of course. Yeah, I was thinking about Ali when I remember I was having you on. So listen, it sounds like, as we're hearing there, that there were a lot of hangers-on and acquaintances and stuff in Garrick's life, but both you and your father, the late Sean O'Riordan, I think you were actual real friends of his, weren't you?
Well, I suppose it goes back a long time. You see, when you're kind of known and you have a role, you sometimes have to fulfil people's expectation of that role. And I particularly felt it a lot in the last, say, 20 years with Gareth. He was obliged to fulfil people's expectations of who he was. And the real Gareth was slightly different. I think he was kind of a very warm. He was very interested in Irish things of all kinds in the Gaelic nation, and that goes back to the 60s. And in a Gaelic nation, it's not just the music section or the poetry section. It's also the sculptures and the artists. It's the history. It's the land. It's nature. Because in the Gaelic nation, we belonged to the land. We didn't own the land. I remember in the early 60s, there was a law in Ireland. Do you remember when there was rates? And the rates were decided by the amount of chimneys on a house. Mm. So lots of farmers would knock the chimneys off houses that had become derelict because people had emigrated, but the house was maybe on their farm. And Gareth had inherited, I think, something like 11 castles from his the Arnmore Browns, the West. And he couldn't afford, he had no money. So I remember him cursing and swearing about the fact that he had all these bloody castles. He couldn't get rid of them, couldn't knock them because they were historical buildings and so on. There was no, and you couldn't live in them, you couldn't sell them, you couldn't do anything, but you still had to pay rates on them at the time. So there's a lot of hidden sides to his life that everyone's homing in now on the eccentricity and so on. Mm. But he was not like that. He was in the public persona, maybe, but privately he was not. I came across him first as a kid, and it was in Roundwood. And I remember that time when, that year, when Daddy Nanulog, if you know who I mean, mm-hmm. Stopped coming. My consolation prize was, it, as it were, was a wolfhound from Garrett called Fionn. And I remember him arriving down the train to Euston Station in Cork in a crate, and my father and the rest was going in to collect him. And I'd be given the instructions like, you have to mind the dog, it's your dog. That night the dog howled to the skies and the moon and got very nervous and crapped and piddled all over the kitchen. And my father came down in the morning and said, your dog, you clean it up.
That and dog thought he was in St. William Street, obviously.
The wolfhound is a very big dog, so obviously. So, but what I'm, the reason I mention it is because he was very close to the family, but also it was a wolfhound he had. It wasn't any other kind of a dog. He was very interested in the essence of the Gaelic nation. And his friends around, like people like Eddie Delaney, the sculptor now and things like that, they were always having conversations. Seamus Murphy, another sculptor. And then they were always talking. Ireland was a different place in the 60s. It was exciting because it was a smaller group of people kind of involved in the whole scene. And it was connected into Scotland with Sorley McLean and the rest of them over there. even Dylan Thomas and people like that in Wales. There was an awareness, if you like, of creating a new nation and so on. That kind of got kind of waylaid in the 70s. If you remember a man called Naomi Chomsky who wrote Manufacturing Consent.
Yeah.
Well, there's been a kind of a manufacturing of what it is to be Irish since then, where they've managed it rather than, I think, going back to the root. I'll give you one other example. With Gareth, my mother had started a co-op here for crafts in the late 90s, 69, 68. My father was alive at the time. And Gareth was very interested in crafts. So Gareth had found a weaver in the Aran Islands who was weaving belts and ties. So my mother then got these lovely tweed belts and ties. You could use them as either to sell in her craft shop, which was a co-op shop. And Gareth used to wear them. And I'm sure maybe James might remember those tweed ties that Gareth had. I have one of them here all the time. They were unique. I haven't seen them in a long time, but they were handmade in the Aran Islands.
Yeah, so it was a kind of a craft folk revival. It was the full lifestyle brand, really. And listen...
But there was more to it than that, Brendan, because I remember there was a thing called Ireland House and Stephen's Green in Dublin, and they were trying to get Irish fashion to strike out on its own with a route into the what you call the folk, but actually to evolve into something new and brilliant. It wasn't a case of reinventing the folk. It was a case of growing out of the folk. I really hate reimagining and reinventing stuff.
I hear you. Pather, as people do down in your part of the country now, we're threatening to diverge here, so we'll come back onto the main road. In terms of then the importance of Claddagh Records, so against the background of all that... That there was nobody recording much of this stuff, was there? Am I right in thinking that when is it Leo Rossum, is that the correct pronunciation?
Yeah.
When he did the King of the Pipers, that there were only a handful of pipers left.
When I was a kid in the 50s, I remember Leo Rossum was up the road. We kind of looked and he was called the King of the Pipers even at that stage. There was a man who called to our house regularly, Tommy Rick. There was the Potts were famous from Wexford, but living in Dublin at that stage. There was Paddy, of course, in the band, who we thought was wonderful because he was one of our own. And Seamus Ennis, who we thought was kind of sour because Seamus was kind of the authority. Yes. And, of course, our friend Willie down in West Clare. I didn't know any other pipers. I was aware of one down in Cork, O'Ravig, Mihal O'Ravig, but I didn't know him at that stage. So it was very. Now there was 36,000 pipers a couple of years ago. On the list. So that's a huge growth.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. All right, Pat, I'll come back to you in a minute. I want to talk to Mairead Ní Maoinigh now. Ní Maoinigh, and Mairead is lead singer with Alton. Good afternoon, Mairead.
Hello, Brendan. How are you? This is really interesting.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? And listen, in what Pather was explaining to us there, a bit of the context of where things were at in terms of, I suppose, the status offered to traditional music, and then I suppose a kind of a folk revival that was going on around the world at the time, would I be right? That Claddagh Records was at that intersection there for young people like you.
Well, I was starting off playing music, and when I first heard the first Chieftains album coming out of the Oireachtas division that came with Oireachtas C80, it really made me think that this music was for listening to as well. Of course, they were focusing in on Cáil an Uasail, which would have been the harp music. And
explain that again.
Cáil an Uasail, which would be the music of the gentry.
Okay,
the high music.
Yeah.
Yes, high music. And that's what Gareth was. He reflected that patronage of... he had a vision, I think. Like, I didn't personally know him. I met him a few times. But I was very impressed with him because he had a vision. And as Pather was saying, he understood the psyche of the Gaelic nation, and he wanted to preserve that. And I'm so delighted to hear that that the archives, and that there's new stuff still to be found in his archives, that he left that legacy. But for me, as a young person starting to play music back then, it was really, really exciting to hear the Chieftains playing as an ensemble rather than, you know, a ceilidh band for dancing. This was for listening, and that was bringing that tradition out into a more modern society, you know.
Okay, I get you. Okay, Mairead, stay with us a minute. I think Mary Hayes is back with us. And Mary, so having been Gareth's librarian originally, you're now the person who is going through the archive, aren't you? You had started on this before he died, is that right?
Yes. So Gareth brought me into the project, introduced me to James and asked me to get a few things out for him. And after he died, James is obviously continuing with the book. And what I was doing was the written material, not the music material. So there were a number of filing cabinets which were totally rich in material, fantastic letters, really reflective of Ireland at the time, Ireland during a time of postal strikes and bank strikes. And it's amazing that records got made.
OK, thanks, Mary. Liam Collins is joining us as well now. Liam Collins, you're a freelance journalist, but you've written a lot about all this down the years. We were hearing there from James about the great old scene down at Lugla. I believe you're one of the very few people who went to Lugla and got invited to stay for a party and said no.
It's one of the great regrets of my life, actually, because it was one of those magical summer afternoons, and we were drinking champagne on the lawn, and Garth was in great form, and John Hurt arrived by helicopter from the races in the Curragh, I think. And I was walking around with Garth. He was showing me around the house and various things in it. And he said, well, stay the night, you know. And first of all, you're not usually invited to stay the night. But I knew it was a Thursday. I knew I had to go back to work. And so I sadly declined. And because I knew I wouldn't get out of there for maybe days on end.
Yes.
And I was a working person. So
Liam,
that was it.
I suppose, though, even talking to Padder there, we get a sense that, you know, as Padder said, people focus on his eccentricity and the outward and all that. That, in a sense, though, at the heart of it was, would you say, a troubled guy or a guy who struggled at times a little bit?
I think absolutely that he did. He had a very unusual upbringing. And he was left a vast fortune, which I'm afraid he got through in his lifetime. And in fact, in the end, he had to leave Lugla. There were dark times in his life when, and I think James touched on it briefly, he did ask himself, what's this all about? And he may have felt that had he not had so much money and so much privilege, that maybe he could have made more of things. But at the same time, you have to say that very few people of his ilk, say, of the ascendancies, you know, most of them were more were concerned with passing on their legacy, their great houses and their family name. But Garth's thing with Cladda is an enormous legacy for both him and I think for Ireland. This, you know, these poets, musicians, that a lot of them probably wouldn't have been recorded at all. And indeed, the night that I refused to go to stay there, or at least I had to go back to work, he told me the MacPeaks were playing, the MacPeak family. They were doing a session later on in the house. And hearing the MacPeaks singing The Summertime Is Coming was probably sparked my interest in folk music way back when I was a kid. So In a way, there is that circle there all the time.
Yeah, yeah. Now, listen, in terms of his family, James mentioned his brother, Tara Brown. Tara, of course, was a kind of a more, he was central character in Swinging London and everything. And he's the guy who's referenced, his car accident that he died of is referenced in A Day in the Life by the Beatles. But he had another brother as well, that you knew this brother better than you knew Garth. Tell us about him.
I did. I was doing a social column, I think, for the Evening Herald at the time. And I used to be around the great Dobbins Bistro. And there was this unusual aristocrat called Dominic Brown. And he didn't seem to have any money. He was an extraordinary man in that he was a Baha'i. And yet he was hanging around with people who were, let's say, enjoying life to the full. And I got to know him quite well. And if anybody knows out the Merrion Road, there's a bottle bank called Shelter Referral. He set up that as a funding to fund homeless people way, way back before people cared about them at all. And he is now the current Lord Oranmore and Brown. But the position was that because his mother was not a Guinness, he had no money, whereas Garrick, whose mother was Una Guinness, he inherited all the wealth. But I remember being at one event, you know, and I used to say to Gara or to Dominic, "Who's that?" And he'd say, "Well, that's Lord Insaney. We call him Lord Insaney, but he's very good fun. Do you want to meet him?" And he eventually left. His father, I think, lived till he was 102. And so Dominic was probably in his late 80s, early 90s when he inherited the title. And he lives in England now.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Can I come
thanks,
in a minute,
Liam.
There, Brendan.
Paller.
Yes, about Garrett. While people think he was insanely rich and so on, that's not really true. His money was organised by the trust. And when Tara died, I remember when Tara died that awful day, there was a lot of legal stuff that went on. And so Garrett was paid by the trust, and he had considerable difficulty, and he was a tax exile then, not by choice. I often was talking to him, and he was having to leave the country because you are allowed so many days at home to be abroad and so on. So it's a complicated affair. But I'd like, before the time runs out, to say that the big thing that Garrett did was not alone that he understood the Gaelic nation and got the best musicians and poets and so on, but he made sure that the idea of an album, that it was well finished, well designed, good notes, well edited, everything done properly as a work of art in itself. And in this day of Spotify and all these other things, it's still important to get a thing like an album.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
Garrett has given us an archive from the 60s. Now, I mustn't forget that Gaelling had started in the 50s.
Yeah.
And they had done tremendous work with the 78s originally from 57 to 61.
And Sean would be more, I would have thought, more associated with Gaelling, wasn't he?
Well, he was friendly with them. But I come back to Ireland, the people being very a small group that time. So there wasn't really competition between Gaelling and Cladder. Cladder were in a slightly different field. Gaelling were doing pure Irish traditional music and were doing a lot of Irish language courses and schemes to fund people living in the Gaeltacht, because there was a lot of poverty that time, and to stop emigration and so on, keep people living in the Gaeltacht. That was Gaelling, and that great trust and charity that was Gaelling and still is today. And I see them cooperating a lot on the new website that Cladder Records have now. You can get all Gaelling's recordings there also. It's a very swish one-stop shop, if you like.
Paddy, will you wait a second there, because I want to come back to you about something in particular. But just, James, before we go, what are the plans now for the archive, or what will we start seeing stuff happening?
Well, the first album will be the re-release of Oireachtas Farewell, recorded in Luggalough some months before Padraig's father passed away.
Okay.
That's this year. Secondly, we will also release the album of Patrick Kavanagh reading his own poetry. Gareth wanted to use Kavanagh's voice, but some people didn't like the earthiness of his Monaghan accent.
Yeah.
But he prevailed, and we have that. And we are also going to have a number of leading people reading their own favourite Patrick Kavanagh poem. And then we have the chieftains. But we are going to release all the material in some shape or form starting this autumn.
Okay, that's fabulous. Now, That's what I wanted to ask you about, Pather, which is Oireachtas Farewell. Funny enough, I would look into listening to some stuff during the week, and that was one I came across, and it's an extraordinary thing. I mean, it's so incredibly intimate and earthy, and I mean, you can actually hear is that banging we're hearing, are they foot pedals or something? You hear a kind of a thud as he's playing the harpsichord.
No, that harpsichord is a very unusual instrument. It's an upright harpsichord from the 16th century, I believe, which Garrett had. He had acquired somewhere, and Sean would regularly be obviously visiting Garrett or vice versa, and Garrett made him promise that he'd play the harpsichord. So there was a harpsichord builder in Dublin who was an ex-Guinness's man, Carl, can't remember his second name for a minute, And he tuned, restrung and tuned the harpsichord, because it being fragile, you'd want to be very careful. It was one chance, really. So Sean recorded the album in an afternoon, a whole series of pieces of music, and promptly got sick within a week or two, and 6 weeks later was dead. Now, when he was in London for the last 3 weeks of his illness, Gareth arrived over. I was over there because Sean had sent me to give me instructions, and Gareth arrived over with a little cassette of the tape that he had just got edited down. But I don't know if Sean actually heard it, because he was too ill at the time. But that's how close it was. And was Gareth then called it Aurelius Farewell.
Aurelius Farewell. And OK, we'll take a bit of that now. Can I say first, thank you very much, Padre Aurelia. Thanks, Mary Hayes. Thanks, Liam Collins. Thanks, Mairead Ní Bhuaigne. And thanks, of course, to James Morrissey. So let's take a bit of that Aurelius Farewell. Now, this is a bit, this is not kind of a slick production for the radio or anything here. You're going to have to go with this and the texture of it, but this is just extraordinary. So we play Mo Gile Mar. Thanks, everybody.